much as markets go down, so too do they go up, even after missile strikes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 8th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, that was an interesting 18 or so hours in the global markets, wasn't it? No sooner had we finished up an explainer on how the markets can price things in if it knows those things are coming, than something came that the markets somehow were not expecting. There was the missile attack last night. Then a not really too belligerent statement from President Trump this morning, and somehow everything was fine. We've called Amy Myers Jaffe for some context on this. She is a longtime Middle East analyst, also now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's do a quick gut check. You heard this news last night. I'm sure you, as I and many other people, checked the futures market. What was your initial reaction?
Well, I think that it makes sense that the markets calm down afterwards. Of course, we're hoping for a peaceful outcome for conflict resolution. But I think the markets may be a little optimistic in the sense that there's a long row to hoe here on a very long and stubborn conflict in the Middle East. So maybe people were a little too optimistic.
This is, if I could go to my Donald Rumsfeld dictionary, this is the very definition of unknown unknowns, right? Yes, the president was moderately diplomatic today, but there's so much yet to come.
There's a lot of water that needs to be crossed, and I think the markets reflect that in the price of gold. Now, of course, gold is also strong because we're expecting a U.S.-China trade deal, and we're expecting a weaker dollar. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I do think that that hefty gold price reflects the sentiment that we're not out of the woods yet.
Talk to me about oil for a second, would you? It kind of makes sense that it's down hard today. Long term, though?
I know that all the analysts are saying long term down for oil. But my feeling is there's still a lot of geopolitical risk to be had. We still have tremendous unrest on the ground. If the Iraqi population is unhappy with the way things go, you know, you could see oil workers decide that they're going to join the anti-government protesters. Or if there's a breakdown in negotiations between the United States, Iran, and Iraq, and the United States, quote unquote, gets kicked out, you could see sanctions on Iraq's oil, because Iraq has been doing these swaps with Iran, these energy swaps with Iran, and that would be a logical next step if things break down.
Are you calmed at all by the fact that the United States is such a major producer of oil now?
That helps me from the point of view of worrying about the U.S. economy. If the price of oil goes way up, there are many states that benefit now because we have so many states that are oil producing that didn't used to be oil producing. And of course, our trade deficit isn't as badly hurt. The problem is, you know, you and I, we might not take a road trip this summer if oil prices are very high. And also, we know from past oil shocks that Americans stop buying cars when the price of gasoline is going up. And, of course, that would be very bad for the economy because that's a big part of the GDP of the United States.
Okay, so short to medium term, what are you watching?
Well, I'm watching sort of how it plays out, of course, in the Middle East. I think that's a very major risk. I want to see that the U.S.-China trade deal comes forward and in what form. And then I think the markets, you know, Eurasia Group, which is a geopolitical risk organization, says the United States is the number one geopolitical risk in the world today. So I do think the U.S. election, depending on which way it swings, could be a major feature in financial markets. So I think we have to watch that very closely.
Eurasia Group co-founder Ian Bremmer, of course, you can hear on the Marketplace Morning Report all the time. Amy Myers Jaffe, she's at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Amy, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thank you, Kai.
On Wall Street today, as I said, everything was fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. brief detour to retail now. Macy's said today it's going to close about 30 stores. It also said sales were off just a touch during the holiday season. That is not great during the all-important holiday season, of course. Pier 1 is closing a bunch of stores as well. We mentioned that yesterday, 450 of them, about half of its total store count. Lest you think, though, that the holidays were completely bleak, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is here to disabuse you of the notion.
We've been telling you for a while that consumer spending is strong. You all continue to fork over your cash and plastic to buy stuff. And that's still true. 2019 holiday sales jumped by almost 3.5% compared to last year, according to MasterCard. Denise Dalhoff is a senior researcher at the Conference Board.
The U.S. consumer is fairly healthy, so we have a good job market. People feel pretty good economically, so they are ready to spend on the right items and in the way that they want to.
The way that they want to, that's the key phrase. Sonia Lipinski is a managing director at Alex Partners.
The retailers who are doing well are the ones who are understanding how the consumer wants to shop today.
Online sales jumped by almost 19% this holiday season.
The consumer continues to migrate towards online.
And you see this trend play out in different sectors of retail. When you look specifically at department stores, for instance, which we know have been struggling, overall holiday sales fell by 2%. But their online sales jumped by 7%. The problem is in the stores. U.S. retailers announced more than 9,000 store closures last year. Lipinski says this doesn't mean brick-and-mortar stores are dead.
However, the experience in store is ultimately is so important today. So they want to, there has to be a compelling reason to go to the store, because otherwise they're just going to be online, they're just going to be on Amazon.
So, New Year's resolution, retailers? Figure that one out. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
New year, a couple of new trade deals looking to get done sometime soon. The USMCA is working its way through the Senate. That China Phase 1 agreement is set to be signed next week. There is impeachment, of course, taking up some of the energy in Washington, Iran as well. But agriculture waits for no one, which is why we've gotten Brian Duncan back on the phone. He farms hogs and soybeans and corn in Illinois, where he is also the vice president of the State Farm Bureau there. Brian, it's good to have you on again.
As always, a pleasure to talk with you, Kai.
So look, the last time we had you on, it was August, it was hot out there, and you said the hogs were getting skinny. And what I want to know, first of all, is whether the hogs are fattening up at all.
Yeah, I think they're fattening up on my farm. And as you look at our weight breakdowns for year over year, they're carrying a lot of weight.
All right.
So yes, the hogs recovered.
Good. Now let's talk about the market. USMCA is soon to be a done deal. There's that phase one deal with China that's going to be signed next week by all accounts. How you feeling? Pretty good, I imagine.
Well, we're hoping there's resulting follow through and a lift in the market. And don't forget about the new Japan deal that put us on level footing January 1 with our competitors who had got a leg up on us for both pork and beef. So, you know, we are hopeful, Kai. This is the start of some good news and, you know, an increasing ramp up in exports that would result in better farm profitability, or at least some farm profitability.
So you say hopeful, which I guess is hopeful, but it doesn't sound like you're saying things are good yet.
Well, how many times have you and I talked and that there's a deal right around the corner and we still haven't rounded the corner? So, yeah, I am hopeful. The Chinese are coming. We're going to sign phase one next Wednesday, is my understanding. So we're hoping that the text and when it's signed it lives up to the hype. And, you know, it seems like USMCA now maybe hit a snag in the Senate. So I guess I'm to the point, Kai, when the ink is dry on the paper, then I'll be a true believer. Until that time, I'm reserving a little bit of emotion.
Fair enough, and I totally understand that. Let me just ask two very specific questions. One is on the China deal. As you say, we haven't yet seen the text of it. The other part of the problem with the Chinese deal is whether they can actually deliver on their promised agriculture purchases, soybeans specifically. Do you believe that they can? I mean, there's demand over there, but is there enough?
Well, you know, a state-driven economy, Kai, can do things that a market-based economy maybe couldn't. Yes, I think they have the potential to make purchases. We've seen numbers thrown around $40 to $50 billion mm-hmm. annually, which would be significantly more than they imported from us at their peak. It would mean us displacing other markets in the Chinese system. We know there's a tremendous demand over there right now for pork because they've lost 40 to 50 to 60% of their swine herd mm-hmm. Due to African swine fever. So in pork alone, there's tremendous potential for them to come in and do a buy at really quite bargain basement prices right now in the United States too.
Talk to me then about 2020. If everything goes right, are y'all or the folks in Illinois anyway, where you are you back to normal?
Well, we hope so. Yeah. I mean, we've been getting a lot of our income. If you look at the USDA figures, a lot of our income this year came from government,
came from the
MFP payments, and we really would like to get back to getting our money from the marketplace. So again, Kai, I'm just going to say I'm hopeful that we see the lift in prices that these deals seem to promise for us. Yeah. Let's see some follow through. And I think maybe you and I need to talk again in August.
We will do that. Hopefully before that. Brian Duncan, he's the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Also, hogs and corn and soybeans for himself as well. Mr. Duncan, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Pleasure as always, Kai.
We did a bunch of reporting on that MFP that Mr. Duncan was talking about, the Market Facilitation Program, the Trump administration's payments to farmers to make up for their losses due to the trade war. You can check out the data that we got from a Freedom of Information Act request and the maps, which are, honestly, here, totally interesting at marketplace.org. Spoiler alert here, the state that got the most money in MFP payments, Illinois. Coming up,
my leg is about $22,000.
Looking for a prosthetic bargain. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 161 points today, 0.5%, 28,745. The NASDAQ record high, 60 points to the good, 0.2%, 91.29. The S&P 500 up 15 points, about 0.4%, 32.53 there. So let's see, Macy's. Up nearly 2.5% today. Pier 1 imports down 17%. We're going to stay with retail for just a bit. The Gap, or maybe it's just Gap, I don't know. Rose 0.2%. Abercrombie & Fitch gained nearly 1.7%. Walgreens lost 5.8% today as the drugstore chain missed expectations. The stock, by the way, is the worst performer in the Dow index over the past year gone by. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.87%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The markets are calmed, Iran-wise, but as we were saying up at the top of the program, it is early days yet, and there could be more than just missiles at issue. Turns out, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, online disinformation is something Iranian hackers have proven themselves pretty good at.
This morning, Americans heard U.S. troops were withdrawing from Kuwait, except they weren't. Kuwait state news agency said its Twitter account got hacked. That could have come from Iran, says Georgetown's Ben Buchanan. His upcoming book is The Hacker and the State.
We don't know with certainty that those have been traced to Iran, but it would seem to fit the fact pattern reasonably well.
A pattern of cyber propaganda spread through social media like fake Facebook accounts. Buchanan says this helps rally support within Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East. On Twitter yesterday, word spread that the U.S. took on dozens of casualties in Iraq. Again, false, but for a while effective, says Kunish Karan. He's with the Atlantic Council think tank's Digital Forensic Lab.
There were more than 40,000 tweets, and it was trending in the United States. It came as a message in a disinformation way from the Iranian state media, but it caused a lot of misinformation in the United States.
Iran has inflicted more traditional digital pain, hacking into U.S. corporate servers, deleting files, and taking down websites. Former Pentagon Undersecretary Jim Miller, now a fellow at Johns Hopkins, worries about certain companies.
One is the financial sector, which they've gone against in the past, the electrical grid, and the third is getting into the information and communications technology sector to disrupt communications.
U.S. intelligence reports say Iran lags behind China and Russia in hacking, but analysts say its cyber army can worm into networks and attack when ready. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There are, roughly speaking, 2 million people in this economy living with some kind of limb loss. The Centers for Disease Control says there are about 185,000 amputations every year, and that is expected to double by the middle of the century because more of us are getting diabetes and vascular diseases. And that gets us to this, how essential prosthetic limbs are for so many people. They are also, though, really expensive. One possible solution? Technology. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
At 14 years old, Annika Emmert has already gone through a lot of prosthetics.
I was actually born without my right arm.
That's the thing with kids. They grow fast, so their prosthetic limbs need replacing pretty often. And for a small person, they can be clunky.
My first ever prosthetic was very heavy for a two-year-old.
It was so difficult to use that she just put it in the toy box.
Yeah, I just put it in my toy box.
It was the most expensive toy box in the hood, kind of deal.
Karen Bryson Emmert is Annika's mom.
Yeah, she just...
I had a lot of my prosthetics in that toy box because of the fact that they never really worked for me.
But every time a kid outgrows a prosthetic, it needs replacing. And that would be another few thousand dollars in deductible costs if you have good insurance. That's the thing with prosthetics. They are expensive, and insurance doesn't always cover everything.
My leg is about $22,000.
Craig DiMartino is a climbing instructor in Colorado. He lost his leg in a climbing accident. Insurance covers 80% of the leg he uses for walking, which needs replacing every few years due to wear and tear.
But with climbing being my living, I also need a leg to climb with.
It's a special climbing leg with no moving joints. It makes it easier to get a grip. That is a second prosthetic leg and another $22,000, which also needs replacing every few years. DiMartino is lucky. He gets help from corporate sponsors and friends. But this is all to say that prosthetics are not just costly. They are costly over and over and over again. And that leaves people either without prosthetics or without the ones best suited to them. Albert Monero is among those trying to change this, at least for kids.
This is some of our manufacturing area.
Monero founded Limitless Solutions, limitless as in limbs. It's a nonprofit run out of the University of Central Florida.
We have four of our 3D printers back here running, and that's how we make all the plastic parts of the arms.
They're using 3D printing and other rapid manufacturing techniques to, they hope, bring down the cost of robotic prosthetics. 3D printing requires far less equipment than, for example, injection molding. Monero says Limitless is among the first to rely on these technologies. These are techniques, he says, that some traditional prosthetics makers have been slower to adopt.
The investment in that in the prosthetics and orthotics world has been lower because the cost to innovate the first set of devices over the last 20 or 30 years already has a cost and is already on the marketplace.
In other words, he says, traditional prosthetics makers are invested in older, more expensive technologies. Limitless is focusing on robotic bionic arms for kids, and these arms are currently in clinical trials. The hope is an arm that costs $5,000 in total. Joe Johnson is a prosthetist at Corum Prosthetics in Windsor, Colorado, meaning he makes and fits prosthetics. He's also an amputee.
The future of prosthetics is definitely heading directly towards 3D printing, for sure.
He says low-cost 3D printing is likely to have the most effect on prosthetic arms, which aren't weight-bearing.
It's important, especially for children, to start using a prosthesis early on in life. Studies have shown if you don't wear a prosthesis when you're young, you're not going to wear one when you're older.
Groups like Limitless are funded through donations, which, in addition to their low-cost manufacturing techniques, is a big factor in their ability to offer low-cost limbs. But even for traditional prosthetics makers, individual components are one of the primary costs. And if those come down, it would reduce costs overall. Annika Emmert, the 14-year-old, got her recent prosthetic arm from Limitless. She flexes the robotic palm open and closed. It's lightweight and grips and can make gestures. It does not blend in. It is a robotic arm, no flesh-colored silicone. And that is how Annika likes it. She designed it herself.
I have silver swirls on like a blue black background, and then there's some like random little dots in between, and I love how it's actually not just like bare skin tone.
Other models are based off characters in the Halo video game series. Recently, Annika was able to do something she was never able to do before.
I can zip up my jacket. I was like, no, let me try this. So I tried it, and I did it. I did it twice, actually.
If the market for prosthetics is disrupted by new manufacturing techniques, more kids may get prosthetics earlier and more cheaply. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace. A household, says the Census Bureau, includes all the persons who occupy a housing unit as their usual place of residence. Everybody under the same roof, in other words, be it house, apartment, mobile home, or otherwise. But one of the premises of our series, Adventures in Housing, is that a household is really so much more than a roof and the people under it. So in today's installment, this story of one household and how it grew.
My name is Sam Weaver.
My name is Jill Weaver.
Jill and I met in high school.
We were high school sweethearts. Sam and I are teachers.
Jill teaches third grade and I teach high school.
Sam and I first bought property in 2007. And we were looking to buy a home that was a starter home, something that we could have a kid or two in.
We bought in fall of 2007, and then, you know, the housing market collapsed. We were quickly underwater on our mortgage. We were able to make mortgage payments, but it was definitely not good.
And then the first day of school hit, and I hadn't been reemployed.
And so with her unemployed for a year, we had to figure out our next steps. We ended up short selling the condo and enter the rental market.
We lost at least $100,000. It still is mind-boggling. At that point, I didn't think we'd ever own a home again.
We were renting in Livermore at the time, one of the neighboring cities, and Jill's parents would have Sunday dinners. They would have us over every Sunday. And at one point, they just kind of came to us. They said, hey, we have an idea. We have a plan.
We are Jill's parents.
I'm Mike Kirsch.
I'm Sylvia Kirsch, married to Mike.
Joe's father, Lucy, and Jack's gramps. In 1983, we purchased a house in Pleasanton, California.
It needed a lot of TLC, so we dived right in and fixed the house up and made it our own.
And we've lived there ever since 1983. We were at the point where we were starting to think about retirement.
We thought, well, you know, this house is really bigger than we need.
And so we proposed it to them.
Mike and I proposed a plan to the kids that we would add a second story. They would own the downstairs, basically half of the house, and we would be upstairs, allowing us to travel, take care of our aging parents, and have the best of both worlds.
I think at first we were like, oh boy, living with my parents, yay!
There's definitely that stigma.
And we definitely went over that for a while. Like, we're like, well, we lost our house, we lost a bunch of money, and we're with my parents. So that feeling of you failed.
But it is a true blessing.
It's okay to get help.
There is no singular one path to either success or even homeownership.
I can't imagine now not living in quite so close proximity.
We have six people living in our house. Me, my brother, my mom, my dad, Omi, my gramps, and seven because my dog, but she's not a human being, so.
No one's in charge.
No one's really in charge. It really is a group thing. It's kind of a shared partnership.
If anybody runs the show, it's probably Penny, the dog.
Tell us about your adventures in housing, would you? Dogs, multi-generational, take your pick. You can do it at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, you have surely by now seen or heard that Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, officially have announced they are going to, quote, step back as senior members of the royal family. They're going to do some charity work, continue to support the Queen, they say, and also, quoting again, work to become financially independent. That will be complicated, but I'm just going to timestamp this right now. You better believe that Amazon and Apple and HBO and Netflix are all working on pitches for them to form a production company. I'm telling you. Okay, we're done. Missiles or no missiles. Dow Industrial's up 161 today, 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 60 points, 0.2%. S&P 500 up 15. That's about 0.4% there. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.